So what I want to do this morning, I'm going to kind of do with a bit of fear and trembling, because it's not what I really planned. What we've been doing, we've been talking about apologetics. We've been walking through kind of a history of apologetic thought and giving some sort of screen time to some big names who are leading the way in how we think about our faith and how we answer questions of the day, you know, starting the early church all the way up to the Enlightenment. And so we sort of ended with Pascal, and we didn't get to Kierkegaard, and I'm sad for that. So what I would normally do is, I take another week, but I don't have that. What I normally do is use this week to talk about some schools of thought, if you will, in our contemporary age for apologetics. And so there's a number of different methods that people use, and there's some names that go along with those, okay? So if you're familiar with this world, then there are names like William Lane Craig, Norm Geisler, Cornelius Van Til, Alvin Plantinga, Joseph Butler, C.S. Lewis, you might, you know, familiar with. So these are guys who have specific approaches to how they think about their faith and how they answer questions of faith. I'm not going to do any of that. All right. instead, what I'd like to do, and I've never taught this before, so I'm a little terrified, and I'm definitely not a scholar when it comes to what I'm going to be talking about. So I'm leaning heavily on other people's work, and then also it's fairly, it's a little abstract, and so I'm a little concerned that it's not going to be helpful, but I think it is if I can do a good enough job of explaining it to you. So, what's that? And that's what I was going to say. So, if you weren't here earlier, September James, who's, you know, not even here today, bless her heart, said last week when it got too heady, she just got on Facebook and started looking up pictures of me with hair. So, if you all pull out your phones, you can find me on Facebook. Other friends from college have posted pictures, and so you can be entertained, if nothing else. But what I'm going to do is I want to try to use a particular philosopher. His name is Charles Taylor. And when you look up Christian apologetics, you're not going to find Charles Taylor. Okay, it's not what he was about. That wasn't really his aim. But I think that his analysis of where we are today as a society, as a culture, is incredibly helpful and incredibly significant as we do think about apologetics. Okay, so let me kind of lead off with this. Sam Brown. What's up, buddy? Good to see you, man. I see that. Sam, go sit with your mother. What's up, buddy? How are you doing? Hey, man. Okay, so real quick, who's familiar with Charles Taylor's work? Other than Steve
Miller. Taylor, the shoe guy?
Cousin. Charles, no? Oh, okay. Okay, good. I can make anything up that I want, you won't know. All right. I feel a lot better about this now. Okay. So let me start with a quick story, all right? So let me tell you about two friends of mine. And we're going to I'll be referring to them, I think, along the way to kind of give you an idea of why this conversation is so important. So friend number one grows up in the church, very much within the evangelical Christian bubble, devout family, strong believers. I can't, you know, went all the Christian camps and was homeschooled and, you know, with Christian education and so on. Gets through college and starts to kind of drift away. And then if you were to ask him after that, he would say, well, no, I'm an atheist, at best an agnostic, but I think he would say atheist. He doesn't believe in God. And if you ask him why, his explanation goes something like this. Science has disproven God. I used to believe childish, irrational things, such as in God and spiritual and supernatural things, but I've grown out of that, and I know none of that's true now, and I've matured, and I'm rational now, and I understand the world as it actually is. Okay, so that would be his explanation. Friend number two, very similar background. Okay, grows up within the you know, a strong believing family, goes to church every week. Family very involved in ministry and so on. he walks away from his faith, I'll put it that way. But his story is very different. He describes it very differently. Okay. When I had this conversation with him, the way he expressed it to me was, he said, Lucas, and this is actually before he had made a decision, if you will, about what he believed. He described it this way. He said, Lucas, I'm really struggling right now because when I'm wearing my Christian hat, I see the world in one light. And it's coherent and it's rational and it makes sense. And I understand all of it. Okay. But if I take my Christian hat off and I put one of these other hats on, the world again looks coherent and rational and it makes sense. So which hat should I wear? And so what he was responding to was, he'd grown up in this world where he was told what to believe. And I pray that he truly is a believer, because at some point he would have certainly confessed that. But again, I don't know his heart. I don't know how all that works. I leave that to the Lord. But what happened is that as he got into the world, he goes off to college. He begins to encounter people who think differently and believe differently, which is great. That continues. And there's these competing narratives that he's offered. I'm going to use that word, narratives. So the Christian narrative is this worldview that he has that is consistent and coherent and rational. But if he simply removes that narrative and adopts a different narrative, he has a new story that is, again, coherent and rational, and it makes sense. Okay. All right. Put those on the side for just a moment, okay? Those are my two friends. Charles Taylor is a Canadian philosopher, and he, in 2006, he wrote this sort of monolithic work called A Secular Age. And when it was first came out, we got some good feedback, but then over time, people began to kind of dig more heavily into it and realized, okay, this is genius, okay? A lot of people began to realize that there was something about his description of where we are today that captured in a way that no one else had, the cultural milieu, the air, the ethos of specifically Western culture. Okay, he's not talking about Africa or Asia or anywhere else. He really is interested in the movement of Christianity in Western culture from Christendom. So think of like the Roman Empire as it adopts Christianity all the way up to our present day. And so what he does in A Secular Age is he essentially gives us a roadmap for understanding not just how we got here, but also where we are. And he tries to give words to it. He tries to give expression to it. And there's a depth and a complexity and a layered sense that he offers that I have not found with any other writers. And this is what I think began to capture people's imaginations. Now, real quickly, let me just tell you that, again, I'm not a Charles Taylor scholar. And I'll admit right off the top, I have not read his book, okay? I've read a lot of excerpts. I've read some extended passages. What I've read, I'll tell you, is very dense. It's very esoteric. It's very abstract. And so, thankfully, this other really smart person named Jamie Smith wrote a much more manageable book. See that? And I read this about 3 or 4 years ago. And about that time, I never saw Charles Taylor anywhere mentioned. Okay, and I read that book, and I was blown away. I was like, if half of what he says about Charles Taylor's writing is true, this is a description of where we are today that I've never heard before. But it seems to me to fit perfectly with what I see around me. Okay. Right after that, Charles Taylor began springing up everywhere. Okay, suddenly I see him. Different sites, different writers, different people are talking about him and begin to grow in influence, which is often what happens. It takes some time for that to be the case. If any of you are familiar with, just to give you one example, any of you familiar with Dr. Keller, Tim Keller? So he wrote a book called A Reason for God years ago. It's a bestseller. If you've read it, fantastic book. Keller, a number of years ago, begins reading Charles Taylor. Actually, I think he read Jamie Smith to start with. Keller's really bright. He probably actually went back and read Charles Taylor, but I know for a fact that he was very influenced by Jamie Smith. It's one of the primary reasons that he took a step back and said, that's a helpful book, but it's not enough. And he ends up writing a second book called Making Sense of God, which is the book that came out in the last year or two. That is his response to Taylor, not a response to Taylor. That's a result of his influence of Taylor, of saying, you're right, this is a different world than I realized, and I need to answer questions in a different way. So highly influential, suffice to say. Okay, so what is Taylor about? What does this look like? This is where it's going to get exciting. Okay, so Taylor says this. Taylor says that we live in a haunted age. He says that the world in which we live right now, it looks one way, but there's a sense in which everything is not as it seems, that we're haunted. And he's going to say both believers and unbelievers were haunted. And here's what he means by that. We have come, and I'm not going to get into the history as much, at least not right now. We've come from this Christendom, right? We've come from this, where it used to be you had to believe in God. Like the idea of not believing God was completely foreign. You couldn't imagine not believing in God. It simply was how things were. That over time, now we find ourselves in this new age, what he's going to call a secular age, and I'm going to define that in a little bit, where now faith is haunted. In the sense that there's this pressure upon faith that believing is almost impossible. It's an absurdity. That if you take a step back from it and you start to think, I believe in God, I believe in faith, I believe in spiritual realm, like this doesn't make sense within this new age in which we live, that there's these competing narratives. So whereas faith used to be simply a given, now faith is contested at every step. It's in every narrative that you see on TV. It's in science, it's in the science narrative. He's going to be clear about that. It's in our politics, it's in our schools, it's everywhere. It's like we can't escape this pressure that's constantly challenging and making faith hard. Okay, so he's going to, and Smith, in his book, he quotes from Francis O'Connor, and I think a description that's extremely helpful here. So let me read this to you. So this is what Francis O'Connor, is a novelist, author, says. What is of gravest importance for me is always the conflict between the attraction for the holy and the disbelief in that we breathe in with the air of our times. It's hard to believe always. In other words, faith is always difficult. Okay, but more so in the world we live in now. There are some of us who have to pay for our faith every step of the way and who have to work out dramatically what it would be like without it, and if being without it would be ultimately possible or not. So what O'Connor is saying here is that this idea of easy faith is gone. That faith is something that we, in a sense, we struggle with. It's a gift from God. We recognize that. Nobody believes apart from God calling us. And yet there's a sense in which we continue to struggle with it because there are all these hauntings. There's all this pressure within the world that's contesting our faith and saying, really, do you believe that? So if this isn't true for you, if you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about, that's in one sense, that's a blessing. Praise God for that. You have this incredible faith, and I mean that sincerely. Faith is always a gift, and I find that there are people who simply believe, and they can't imagine not believing. That's beautiful. Praise God for that. You don't have to listen to anything else today, okay? I think for most of us, though, if we're honest, we realize that we live in a world in which faith is very much optional. There's nothing that makes us believe. There's a lot of good reasons not to believe, it feels like. There's a lot of pressure not to believe. There's a lot of pressure upon this faith. And so our faith is haunted in this sense. And so I'll just tell you, for me, I'll just be real honest. Like, the way O'Connor describes this, you know, I love this. Pay for our faith every step of the way and have to work out dramatically what it would be like without it, and if being without it would be ultimately possible or not. I get that. That language makes sense to me. That resonates with me. Because maybe it's because I'm a philosopher, and I think abstractly and so on. But there are times when I go, really? Is this what I believe? Does this make sense? And I have to wrestle with, okay, what is faith? And what are the implications for it? And what would I be giving up if I let it go? And what would I be accepting if I hold on to it? There is a struggle within this nature of faith. It's something that is an ongoing struggle within even the life of believers. Okay. This is what my friend, number two, was experiencing, right? He was paying for his faith every step of the way, and he was imagining what would life be with it or without it, and counting the cost in one sense. And obviously, he's going to make a different decision than I do. Okay. Now, here's the other side of it. All of us are haunted, though. It's not just the believers. Unbelievers are haunted. Because the world of Christendom, there's no escaping it. It's where we came from. It's in the air we breathe. It's all around us. There's this sense of the transcendent that we can't escape. This is what Taylor wants to argue for. That even for believers who may confidently proclaim that there is no God, it's a bit disingenuous. That there's a sense in which surely there's something more. Now, they may look for that something more somewhere else, but his point is that there's a haunting within our culture, within this age in which we live, within Western culture, that you can't escape because it's simply where we've come from. So he gives another, so Smith gives another example of this. Julian Barnes, anybody read? He's written a couple of different books. He's an atheist. And did not grow up in church, never set foot in a church, has nothing to do with religion, organized religion whatsoever, okay? He wrote a book called Nothing to Be Frightened Of, and he's talking about death, really. It's sort of a treatise, self-exploration through death, like what is it? Nothing to Be Frightened Of. And he opens with this line, "I don't believe in God, but I miss him." And throughout his book, what you find is that there is this honesty, and Smith quotes him numerous times in trying to explain this haunting that unbelievers feel. He quotes him repeatedly, saying, listen to his language, listen to as he writes, and even as he denies God, there's this longing that there'd be something more, that there's something that's been lost along the way, and that we want to find it. We look for it all over the place, right? But we can't escape it. And Taylor says, yeah, see, we're haunted. We're haunted by spirituality, we're haunted by transcendence, regardless of what the narrative of the world that says, no, it's only nature, it's only materialism, says, no, very few people actually believe that. There's this haunting. Let me give you one other passage that Smith quotes that I think is really fascinating. David Foster Wallace is an author, and he wrote some really profound, also incredibly dense works. And here's someone who is also haunted, not a believer, takes his life later, and actually at a fairly young age, but in some ways writes for the postmodern voice. And this is what he said. He wrote a short story called All of That. And in it, he describes, he's referring to himself. It's a made-up story, but he's referring to himself in the first person. And he talks about being a child who, his parents give him a little toy cement mixer. And they tell him, this is a magic cement mixer. When you don't look at it, the cement mixer turns. But when you look at it, it stops. And so Wallace says so as a little boy, he spends all of his time trying to catch the cement mixer moving. But this is what he says, and this is interesting. He says, and as an adult, I realize that the reason I spent so much time trying to catch the drum rotating was that I wanted to verify that I could not. If I had ever been successful in outsmarting the magic, I would have been crushed. And so what you expect then, this is Smith's sort of analysis of it, he said you would expect that this is a story of maturity. So think back to my friend number one. He says, I used to believe in childish things. I believe it was irrational to believe in God, to believe in spiritual things. But now I know the truth. I have matured. I am rational. I'm an adult. And so what Smith says about Wallace's story is that's where you expect this to go. I used to think that was a magic cement mixer, and then I wised up. But that's actually not what Wallace says. He says, actually, looking back, this is the grown narrator, says, looking back, the origin of the religious feeling that has informed most of my adult life came from a sense of reverence for what he could not understand. He didn't want to catch it. He wanted there to be something that was beyond what he could explain. He would have been crushed if he'd seen it. So this is what he says. So the fact, this is again the narrator, the fact that the most powerful and significant connections in our lives are at the time invisible to us seems to me a compelling argument for religious reverence rather than skeptical empiricism as a response to life's meaning. And so his conclusion is this. On the one hand, this is childish. I know it's childish. I can't believe this. It's impossible for me to believe this, and yet I want to. I can't escape this haunting. I can't escape this need for transcendence, for reverence. And there's no getting away from it. He can't get rid of that feeling. And so there's this tension, and this is what Taylor wants us to understand, that there's this tension for both believers and for unbelievers in this present time, that there is a tension not to believe, a pressure not to believe for believers, but also there's a pressure to believe for the unbeliever, that we're haunted in both directions. There's cross pressures. And so for people of faith, we recognize that there are these competing narratives, that our faith is always under this pressure. It's always contested in the marketplace, in the marketplace of ideas, social media, all of this. But also that for the unbeliever, what we understand is that there is a longing for something more, and that there's a longing not to be proven right. And this is Wallace's, I don't want to know that it wasn't magic. I want to believe that there was some magic in the world. They're longing for that. So this is part of Taylor's picture of the world, as he says, look, there's been a disenchantment that's taken place with the loss of spirituality. There's a loss of transcendence that happened as we've lost direct connection with transcendent, as we've removed God from our lives. There's a loss of transcendence, and there's a loss of enchantment, of this idea that there's something more that we can't simply explain. And he says that, and his conclusion is, though, that there's this longing to rediscover it. There's a longing to find it. Okay, let me stop there for just a moment. And if you have questions, I cannot promise I can answer them in any way, shape, or form. But I'll at least give it a shot. Is that you kind of tracking with me so far? Kind of a picture of, scene is like, no, no. Facebook, it's Lucas Rogers. Okay. All right. So for Taylor, he's going to say this. Living in a secular age isn't what we think it is. And he's kind of saying, don't believe the narrative that is the popular narrative and what seems to be pushed most frequently within society and peddled, he would say. When he's talking about living in a secular age, what he's saying is one, he's not referring to secular as in like a secular versus sacred, like this is secular space versus sacred space. That's a very superficial designation is what he's going to say. That's not that important. But he also says we don't live in a secular age in the way that the secular humanists want us to believe. What they want us to believe is that we have bought that narrative of my first friend. The secular humanist narrative is we've grown up. We've matured. We don't believe in all that magic nonsense, that enchantment nonsense, that transcendence, the spirituality, a spiritual realm, God, any of that. We've grown up. We're past all of that. And he says, that's actually not where we live either. And he's going to take that on pretty strongly, and I'll get to that in just a moment. Instead, what he's saying in being a secular age is that we don't live in Christendom anymore, and there's no going back. And this is really important. We can't go back. We can't recreate that. We can't try to change our culture and change society to the point that we can go back to what it was. And in fact, he's going to say that's not a bad thing, and I agree with him. But instead, he says, we live in a secular age in the sense that it's a level playing field. It used to be impossible not to believe in God, and now we live in a time where there are all these competing narratives, and it's open season. And so we're surrounded by all these narratives. And so the positive or the negative is that we have faith that's contested constantly by these other narratives. But also, he says the reality is not what the secular humanists say. It's actually that there's also doubt that comes in for the unbeliever because of this longing for transcendence. So according to Taylor, put it this way, our secular age, right, this level playing field is haunted. That belief is contested and contestable. You can argue against faith, and a lot of people do it. And there's no going back to Christendom. And so in this sense, belief, because of where we are, and I'm going to come back to this because this is really important. Because of where we are now, belief, in a sense, only lies through doubt. It only lies through making your way through all of these competing narratives. You can't get away from it. You can't be, unless you're going to be, you know, completely secluded from the world and so on, you can't live in Western culture and in any way enact and engage with the world and be buffered from all these competing narratives. Your faith will be contested. And so in that sense, belief necessarily lies through doubt, through making your way, navigating through all these. And so in that sense, easy belief, like this given, well, of course I believe, isn't actually possible in our age. And the people, when they say that, most of the time is not referring to true authentic faith, but it's referring to some sort of a cultural acceptance of faith. Mm-hmm. So you see this, we see this certainly within like North Dallas or Dallas context, Bible Belt area. Well, of course I'm a believer. When I was living in Italy, we saw this pretty clearly. Of course I'm Catholic. Well, what does that mean? Well, it has nothing to do with an actual religious or spiritual experience. It has everything to do with how you were brought up. So easy belief in that sense is not possible, but disbelief also faces this doubt. It's haunted by the sense of something more that the secular humanist narrative can't answer. It can't provide. All right. Not only that, though, Taylor's going to say that because we've lost this direct connection to transcendence, we live in what he's going to call a flatness. We used to have this sense of God's presence. Again, we had no choice but to believe in God. It was impossible not to believe in God. And regardless of, there's all kinds of, I hesitate to use these for examples because this is not our tradition. But for a long time, there was a sense of the transcendent in nature. We lived in a cosmos that God created, and there was wonder. If you were from, like, for example, you think of Christendom, when the Catholic Church, there's a sense of the sacraments, that there was actual God embodied in it, right? There was this enchantment of the things around it. But we would say, even if we don't agree with that, we say that the cosmos, God in nature, God working in the world, and that has been lost to the sense of now there's this flatness, that the transcendence has been lost, and so now we live where everything is explainable. Everything is, we have a scientific answer for everything. And we feel this, Taylor wants to say, in the monotony of life, in the mundane. In fact, he says this is one of the most terrifying places that you'll see it. Let me read this, and then I'll come to you. So this is what, there's a quote from Taylor. He says, "This is where it hurts most. Some people feel a terrible flatness in the everyday. And this experience has been identified particularly with commercial, industrial, consumer society. We feel the emptiness of the repeated accelerating cycle of desire and fulfillment in consumer culture. The cardboard quality of bright supermarkets or neat row housing in clean suburbs. Having lost the transcendent, we now go searching for other things to fill this need. But what we discover is it's flat. It lacks depth, and it lacks anything it lacks that sense of something more, of something beyond us." And he says it leads to despair. It's almost crushing for people to live in a cycle of consumerism and materialism. It never ends. James.
And if you take that flatness and that worldview to the logical conclusion, and I get stealing this a lot from Keller and stuff, there's no right and wrong, there's no meaning, there's where there's no truth.
Yeah.
And so, and it's crushing, it's terrifying. I think he calls it an existential angst.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's where Taylor is going to say, ultimately, people then try to create and manufacture that meaning within the flatness. And this is one of the, part of the optimism of the post-postmodern society is that if modern society was, this is, we have all the answers, postmodern was, we have none of the answers, and there's this cynicism. The post-postmodern, at least by some people's description, is now coming back and saying, well, actually, maybe there's some truth in there somewhere, little t truth, that we do desire, but we can sort of create ourselves. There's this optimism that comes with that. And Taylor talks about that, but he's going to say that those things are really important, and but their importance, he's going to say, is directly tied to this idea of the something more, right? It's not just the sense of you got to have meaning. He's like, meaning really isn't all like, okay, you have meaning, great. He's like, well, no. It's the fact that you want meaning that is eternal, that is connected to something beyond us, something more. And that's where it gets its weight. Yeah, Janae.
Question.
Yeah.
So is this,
I will try to answer.
I don't even know if I can verbalize the question. Is this where you see, like, I'm thinking of, like, my friends who are unbelievers who they're very intellectual and y'all went to a nerdy science high school together. So
right.
What I see with them is, like, such a passion for movements and
yes.
Because they've made their cause their god, so to speak, because they don't, like, they're almost all, like, agnostic or, mostly agnostic, not really atheist. They're like, because they'll throw out, like, prayers or good vibes and all those words.
Right.
You know, that they want to
yeah.
do
yeah.
something bad happens. I don't know what that means, but there is such a passion, like, this for whatever their thing is. That it is. And, like, it's like, that's, they treat that the way I treat my faith, like if you're all in on it, and you should be all in on it, and I mean they're evangelical about it, like, really in the way that, and I'm like, is that the replacement in that flatness? Is it that looking for some kind of meaning, truth?
I think so.
Rise, because I feel like there's such a rise in like causes and movements again.
I think so. I think what he would say is that that is. That's their attempt, but it's going to fall short.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to be enough because it's not actually connected to the transcendent.
Right.
So he's actually really, like, cynical about it and calls that, like, morality. What does he say? He's got, like, a really hilarious term for it. Basically, like, that's trendy morality now.
Yeah.
You know?
It is.
And he's like, it's really superficial is kind of his analysis of it. Yeah. And so... One of the things we're going to get to is, as he talks about this, is that there's this, there does become this need to define your own spirituality, and this is where people are moving, but he thinks that it's going to move beyond it. That's kind of his analysis of that. So do I see somebody else? Yeah, James.
And Keller talks about this, is that there's a need for someone outside of myself to look at me and say there's a rightness.
Yes. Yep.
What this is trying to do is go out and get everybody else's opinion that are my equals and say, look, I have a rightness. But it falls short because it needs someone that can see down inside me and know everything about me and still say, there's a rightness.
Right. So Taylor gives this hilarious, I think, analysis of fashion with regard to that. And he talks about how there's this need for individuality. Within it, and yet because we're driven through this consumer, consumerism is like the new magic is how he refers to it. And so what ends up happening is we purchase in order to self-identify, but we also purchase in order to show people who we are and get acceptance. And so Smith's analysis is basically we're all 13-year-old girls now. That's his conclusion. Yeah, he's like, we're all 13-year-old girls. That's his sort of summary of it, is that there's this desire. So this is the suburb, you know, this is the suburban, Taylor even says, this is the suburban kid who goes and gets a skateboard with anarchy written on it. and with all of his buddies, right? And it's like, okay, this is, yeah, and they're all dressed the same, right? So there's this non-conformity that pertains to this need. On one, I define myself, but I still need somebody else to tell me that it works or that it's okay. All right, let me keep going here for a second. Okay, so so this is the picture that Taylor's trying to describe more than anything. He's putting it into words, but he's not doing it in this propositional sense. He's trying to almost describe this general malaise that we feel within culture, both believers and unbelievers alike. And so for Taylor, and I think this is hilarious but really helpful, he kind of doesn't care if you don't get it. He's kind of like this. He's sort of like, if you're, so I put it like, if I was Taylor, this is what I would say to you. If you get this, like if you're hearing this and you're like, I get that angst, that existential angst that Keller talks about, you get this sense of malaise, this sense of haunting, then that's your proof that what I'm talking about makes sense and that there is this longing for the transcendent. If you don't feel that malaise, he's kind of like, I don't really have anything for you. Like, there really isn't any other option for you. And so he's just kind of like, that this is it. This is kind of like you either get this and you feel it and there's this sense of something more and or he's like, I don't know, good luck. he just doesn't really have anything else. That's your proof that this is all true. Okay, so let's go back to, let's see here. We got 10 minutes. Let's see here. Okay, let me make one really quick point here because I think it's really important. So my friend number one, one of the things that Taylor wants to take to task is this narrative of the secular humanist. This is really in his sights through a lot of what he's writing. He's trying to combat this and say, I'm not buying this narrative of how we got to where we are. Okay, so what the world, like the secular humanist narrative is, we used to be in Christendom, and then what happened? We grew up. We were childish, irrational, and so forth, and now we grew up. My friend number one, I used to believe in all that nonsense, and now I don't believe in it. And what Taylor wants to say is those are what he calls subtraction stories. And he says they're not real. That by subtraction, he means that they're basically saying you have removed all of the childishness and the irrationality and all of this, and now you find yourself as this pure, unadulterated, rational view of the world. And he says, no way. That's totally not true. And so what he does is he then explains that, and he goes through history and explains how we got to where we are. And his point is this, that narrative, don't buy it. The truth is, something has to be added along the way. That as you switch stories, you're not abandoning a false story for a true story, but actually you have to switch stories because you have to have a story. You can't simply subtract away and end up here as though this is the pure pearl that was left. He says, no, what you've done in reality is you've said, I don't accept this story, and you're adopting a new one. And it has everything to do with your sense of self, your spiritual journey, your subjective identity, all of these things, and it has nothing to do with what science has proven or disproven, basically. He's like, that's helpful. You can, like, if that's the narrative that you choose, you're going to fall back on that, but he basically says, don't believe it. So, friend number one, if you know his full story, you realize that his story is a fabrication. Because what actually happened was, he had a very significant tragedy in his life, and God didn't answer his prayer the way that he wanted. And that's when he decided to switch stories. The rest of it was an excuse for justifying the new story that he'd adopted. And Taylor says, that's normative. That's the normal way that people switch stories. It's not science disproved God. It's I've decided not to believe in God, and science, I'm now going to use and interpret science in such a way to back that up. Okay, let me get to this last part here, because this is important. We now live in not just a secular age, but Taylor says we live in an age of authenticity, and by that he means spirituality, where it once was religion was part of the state, God had divinely instituted. The king is appointed by God, right? The king, I read a lot of historical fiction, and if you go back, and I'm actually starting to read just pure history now because I'm so fascinated by it, and it really is incredible to hear, to consider and to imagine, like, living back in Britain in the Middle Ages. Your king is appointed by God. When the king decides to take over France, that's because God is leading him to take over France, right? And the French king is of the devil. And of course, the French king is being told, you are divinely appointed by God, and the British, they're the devil, right? Okay, so this is what Christendom sort of ended up being the enterprise of that. Along the way, it began to shift. And so when we get to, for example, the formation of America, things have shifted to where religion now is now our responsibility to construct our governments in reflection of God or reflection of how God operates and so on. But all that's lost. And there's no going back. Where we are now, spirituality has been completely deinstitutionalized. It is now individualistic. It is now a spiritual quest for each person. And as such, choice is the highest value. You have all these competing narratives, so you need to be able to choose. And tolerance is the greatest virtue, because I need to let everybody else choose whatever they want. And consumerism, this is where Taylor says, it's the new magic, because it's what allows you to pick whatever quest is going to be fulfilling and so on to you. Now, this is what's interesting, is that Taylor, though, is not going to lambast this. He's not going to say, oh my gosh, these people who are all subjective and individualistic. He says, no, look, that's just where we are. Like, there's no point cursing the darkness. He says, this isn't all bad. So he's going to give a couple of reasons for that. For one, he says there's no point going back. There's no point lamenting what's been lost. He says, and two, he says, just because... this is really important. Just because the framework of spirituality, think of it this way, just because the way in which I go on my quest is subjective and individualistic, it doesn't mean that I don't end up in the right place. Just because the framework, that's the word he's going to use, I'm going to say, like, the quest that I go on to discover my spirituality is... subjective and individualistic, and there's no getting away from that. Like, it has to be in this age. Just because that's the way I go on that quest, it does not mean that I end up in the wrong place. And so, in fact, in my notes it says, living in the secular age means that the spiritual quest of the individual might very well end up with religion. And he's speaking very much about Christianity here, because, again, he's looking at this Western Christendom, you know. So this is what we see all of the studies with millennials. Okay? Right now, all the different writings, everything is coming out, is that the next generation is looking for what? They're looking for a return to an ancient faith. Now, how did they get there? They didn't start with the ancient faith, because that's gone, and there's no going back. It wasn't handed to them. Well, we believe in God because everybody believes in God, and that's what all of the world, not just their parents, but like all of culture was telling them. They were handed individualized, subjective spirituality. You go discover it. And what do they want? Ancient Christianity. They want liturgy. They want mystery. They want transcendence. They want worship that can't be explained. They want an encounter with the Holy God. And so that's what Taylor is saying. Yes, he didn't say anything about millennials. They weren't talking about millennials when he wrote this. But that's what he's anticipating. Okay. And so Taylor's going to say, look, where we are is actually better than where we used to be. We don't want Christendom. We don't want where we've been. There's a lot of reasons for thinking this is better. And so, for example, he says, if our age, where we live now, tends to multiply somewhat shallow and undemanding spiritual options, he goes, that's a possibility. It could just be consumerism, and we just kind of pick and choose. He says, but we shouldn't forget the spiritual cost of various kinds of forced conformity. hypocrisy, spiritual stultification, inner revolt against the gospel, confusion of faith and power, and worse. And so he argues this is a better place to be. Okay. I'm just going to wrap up with a few observations. I've got some other things that I wish I had time for. Sum up with this. Taylor's point is this, that we live in this haunted age. And so what we don't want to do, or what he says is useless, is to rage against it. This is simply where we are. And instead, he's saying, let's embrace it. And what we instead want to do is, understanding the age, we want to look for hauntings for ourselves, for our kids, for unbelieving friends, and use those as opportunities for conversation. And really, he's going to say, ultimately, this is the work of the Holy Spirit, as they go, wow, this transcendence thing, like, they're not using that language, but I'm looking for something more, and no matter what I keep doing, it falls short. So here's what I think are a few implications for us. Our kids are going to go on a spiritual quest, and we need to get used to that idea. If we think that we can simply go in and we can control what our kids believe or tell them this is what you should believe and they're simply going to accept it. My kids do right now because 8 and 5 and younger, okay? So I say, this is what we believe. And they're like, this is what we believe. The reality is they're going to go on a spiritual quest. And so rather than fear that, I think a healthier approach is to walk with them through that quest. And the goal is to show them that in this longing for transcendence, that they will inevitably feel and sense Christianity offers the best explanation. That nothing else satisfies that. Nothing else answers that. And, you know, to James' point, Keller does a really good job of explaining that. That there is this longing for acceptance. There's this, you know, this longing for transcendence that only God is going to be able to answer. But I think it's important that we don't fear the spiritual quest of our kids, but that we anticipate it. We're ready for it, and we're able to walk alongside them with it. So that's just one idea. The other is that humility and kindness, I think, are, and the ability to empathize with our kids or with other unbelievers is extremely important. Part of Taylor's thing is simply telling them, no, this is the right worldview to have, is wholly ineffective. You can't simply argue with them and say, no, this is the right way to think. So no, it's better to listen with humility and kindness, to empathize and to listen for this desire for the transcendent, and in that to be able to engage with them. But understand, this takes a lot more time. This has to do with relationships, having conversations with people over time, whether with your kids, neighbors, or whoever. Obviously, with our kids, you've got that relationship, which I think is helpful. None of this is a denial of truth. None of this is a denial of the truth of Scripture or the authority of Scripture. It has to do with understanding the age in which we live and how to best engage with people, simply understanding this is the age in which we live. This is our time. This is our culture, and there's no getting around it. I've got a few others. I'll put them in my notes that I'll send out to you guys, but I know we're out of time. So I hope that wasn't completely horrific for you guys. I would love to... Did you have a... Doing this?
Well, I was just going to say this is electrifying for me.
Okay.
Answering two questions, one that's 28 years old.
Okay.
And the other one that's 48 hours old.
Oh, okay.
And the 28-year-old one was, I had a very strange trip in college, which was another story for another time.
Okay.
But in a very significant upper-level philosophy class, it turned out that my professor, who hates God, was very clear about that, very, very forthright about that, and I ended up sitting alone in the classroom one day and said, why are we the only two that are so engaged? We both lost. And that's what we were talking about. I lost because the culture had moved on from God. He lost because he inadvertently created an entire society of relativists. So Luther lost when he made us all priesthood of believers, And Nietzsche lost when he killed God.
Yeah.
And now we're both sitting here with nothing.
Yeah.
48 hours ago, my son called me from Cairo and told me that he's thinking about the Coptic faith as being the most true expression of authentic Christendom that he'd ever encountered.
There it is. Yep.
And those two questions, one that's been burning in my mind for 28 years, how did we both lose?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yep.
And how did my professor, who literally meditated on Kant every single day as we would on scriptures,
poor guy.
The same.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then why did my son call me 48 hours ago and say the Coptic faith was the most incredible experience he'd ever had?
We have to go, but I love this. One of the things that Taylor talks about with modern apologetics, this is the danger, he says, and this is, I think, what you're referring to, Bruce, or at least it's what triggers in my mind. He said, we both lose, in a sense, because we're playing from the same playing field, and we're coming at it from, sorry, I'm not able to articulate this well enough, fast enough. He basically says they end up seeming like intramural affairs, as opposed to helpful dialogues that actually engage anyone other than us. So you basically have the person who hates God and the people who really love God, and they're having this intramural battle, and everyone else goes, that's irrelevant, I don't really care. That's kind of what he ends up saying. And so Cameron, on his personal spiritual quest, ends up looking at the ancient faith. It's a fascinating. Yep. Okay, guys, I wish we had... Someday I'm going to do like a whole month just on Taylor because I think it's fascinating. I'll try to do a better job with it. Thanks for indulging me. It was a lot of fun. I'll let you guys go. God bless.